Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I know we were wrapping up the Kentucky resolutions of 1798. And I think there was a go back with Tammy, but Tammy doesn't make this recording time slot, whatever. So we will probably jump back to any questions or residual conversations, because we did go down a couple of rat holes regarding immigration and so forth in respect to the Kentucky resolutions. So, folks, make sure you keep track of these things, because down the road, when people say, hey, you know, the federal government needs to improve the immigration process or what, you can quickly cite the Constitution and the Kentucky resolutions, where Thomas Jefferson helps everybody realize that the states are the ones that are supposed to be controlling this, not the federal government. Just like the states are supposed to be controlling our energy plan, our energy strategy. How in the heck did we get strapped with this inferior, suspect and actually fatal system that they're basically laying upon us with these windmills and solar farms and all this other crap? Because the federal government is waging warfare in every way possible. They don't care how many people get hurt. They don't care how many people die from extreme weather, because there is, you know, there's no electricity for you, because that's a part of the strategy. Just remember, the globalists have come right out and told us in the 1980s that there are way too many people on this earth, and a lot of billions of people need to die. That's all inscribed in those Georgia guidestones, which just as miraculously as they appeared, they disappeared. They were up there for several decades, and all of a sudden they disappeared. But anyway, that debt is fraud. It is now or never, and we need to continue to learn, pray, and act. And everything we're trying to help you get out of these resolutions is understanding how to oppose these constitutional infractions, how to demand full compliance to the Constitution. Because it is through full compliance that we will actually be able to get all of our liberties back and actually be able to start creating a framework of government from the counties up that literally brings the power home to you at the county level. That's all through, if we're focused on constitutional compliance, that's the way we get to that. If we don't do this and we continue to go down this path, you think it's bad having bureaucrats a few thousand miles away from you in D.C. Just wait until the globalists, who could be tens of thousands of miles away from you, as they start dictating their policies and what you must do. And who knows? They may actually be moving themselves into space, because it'll be too harmful to inhabit this earth if they keep doing the things that they're doing. So, and then at some point in time, they may be only a couple of miles away from you overhead as the earth turns, and then sometimes thousands and thousands of miles. Anyway, I digress. So welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
It's great having you back. So was there anything from the last show that you wanted to bring up that you felt that this wasn't time? And I get that. So now's the time.
No, sir. I think we're good to move on.
Okay, great. Well, the one resolution we didn't close on is the ninth resolution. So this is a short and sweet one. And so let's go ahead, and if you can pick this up, we can kind of close out the Kentucky resolutions of 1798.
Will do. Resolved that the said committee be authorized to communicate by writing or personal conference at any times or places whatever with any person or persons who may be appointed by any one or more co-states to correspond or confer with them, and that they lay their proceedings before the next session of assembly.
Okay, so who is the said committee that they're talking about?
the committees that are going to audit the laws according to the Constitution?
Yeah, so these, if you go to the very top of Resolution 8, this is where, or 7, I mean. No, it's 8. The a committee of conference and correspondence, that's the committee they're talking about forming. In other words, this is a committee that will now be conferring and communicating with the other states. The function of a committee of correspondence is a committee that has interstate communications. Not intrastate, but with other states. So anyway, so now he's basically saying that this be authorized now to communicate and create this conference so that later on they can basically provide, you know, what the determinations are, you know, through these proceedings of this committee to the General Assembly, in other words, to the state legislature. They didn't have the ability to just say, hey, let's set up a Zoom meeting. They didn't have the ability to just, you know, meet quickly amongst the states. It was a very arduous process. Doing this took an allocation of resources that was pretty significant compared to today. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so great, because the times are different, but I mean, when it comes down to these types of violations of the Constitution, you can't spare the expense at the expense of the Union, period. So that's one of the reasons why Thomas Jefferson was so adamant. Okay, so boom, he put that 9th resolution in. It went out, and it was viewed by the General Assembly of the Kentucky Legislature. They signed off on this, and they ratified it and sent it out on the 10th of November to all the other states. Let's just say they signed off on it on the 10th, and probably the 11th, 12th, whatever, the next dispatch going out, they sent a copy to each of the states. So each of the states received this. Madison, up over in Virginia, because Kentucky now is, you know, an interstate or a state that's in the hinterland and is not a coastal state. So Madison receives word that the Virginia legislature has received a correspondence from Kentucky, as like all the other states received this correspondence. Now, I actually have all the correspondence because what Virginia received. Maybe it was Kentucky. Anyway, I have one of the states that received the correspondence from the other states. And I haven't put that up, and possibly I could put that up onto my website, but I haven't done that yet. So I need to probably look and see if that's in play or what have you. But nevertheless, it would be helpful if you read these things, because you can see how the paradigm in these other states completely contrasted, one, how the Constitution was ratified, and how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were specifying the process of what needed to be done. In other words, they're basically saying, hey, we're subjects of this federal government. It's almost like we created a Britain with a monarchical federal government, or despotic federal government. Anyway, so Madison gets the word, or maybe he was lingering down in Richmond at the time. Regardless, Madison gets to Richmond, and so if Madison has to travel, and we're talking hundreds of miles, I have no idea from Mount Pilier to Richmond what that was in miles, but it wasn't, you know, just getting in a little plane, a crop duster, and just flying down there. He had to travel, and he had the bilge. I believe that's what he referred to it as, the bilge. That was a digestive problem, so when he traveled, it would just wreak havoc on him. And so he probably had to take several breaks to get down there. So that's what I'm saying. He was probably lingering in the Richmond area at the time, just so he would be there in time when they received the correspondence so he could start working with them. So they started working, and they produced the Virginia resolutions, which ended up getting signed and sent out At the very bottom of this, you'll find that it was agreed to by the Senate on December 24th, 1798. A Christmas present, which they didn't even respect or honor, I should say, not respect. They didn't recognize Christmas in those days. It was a pagan holiday, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So, anyway, let's dive into these resolutions. And the real meat is really towards the very beginning and towards the end. But Madison feels it's necessary in the middle to kind of reemphasize or to point out things that are heir apparent. So anyway, let's dive into the very first resolution, if you would please, sir.
Resolved that the General Assembly of Virginia doth unequivocally express a firm resolution to maintain and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of this state against every aggression, either foreign or domestic, and that they will support the government of the United States in all measures warranted by the former.
Okay, so that's the first resolution. And so let me just break this down. So the first thing he sends out is this General Assembly doth unequivocally express a firm resolution to maintain and defend this Constitution, the United States Constitution, and the state constitution, against every aggression, either foreign or domestic, as you just read this. And then he says, as all measures warranted by the former being the United States Constitution, because when there's a list, there's the former and the latter. The former is the first listed, the latter is the last listed, and usually with two. I mean, so if you got multiple out there, then you'd need, you know, the former and then the first, the second, third, fourth, if you're going to literally go through the entire list. But he basically just lays it out, you know, in a simplistic term, warranted by the former. In other words, warranted by the Constitution of the United States. He's defending, or he's basically saying that the General Assembly, not he, that the General Assembly is going to defend this Constitution against every aggression, either foreign or domestic, as called for by the United States Constitution. Okay, so let's dive into the next resolution.
Number two, that this Assembly most solemnly declares a warm attachment to the Union of the States, to maintain which it pledges all its powers, and that for this end, it is their duty to watch over and oppose every infraction of those principles which constitute the only basis of that union, because a faithful observance of them can alone secure its existence and the public happiness.
Okay, great. Now, as he lays out in this second paragraph, or the second resolution, that one, they solemnly declare this warm attachment, basically this assembly most solemnly declares a warm attachment to the Union of the States. In other words, they're assuring all the other states that, you know, they have the highest regard for them as states, as well as the Union being a sovereign state as well. So they're laying out this, you know, hey, we love you, you're our brothers. And then they basically say, to maintain which it pledges, the state of Virginia, all its powers. In other words, when a state, just so you understand here, when a state joins the Union to, you know, to basically become married with these other states in basically validating the Constitution and submitting themselves to all things constitutional. That's why it says, which it pledges all its powers. So in other words, the states are literally pledging to themselves all their powers to all things that are constitutional. Nowhere are they pledging to be subjects to the whims and desires of madmen or people that want to assume tyrannical powers or anything like that. And then for that end, it is their duty to watch over and oppose every infraction of those principles which constitute the only basis of that union. So what is the only principles that constitute the basis of that union?
The things in the Constitution.
There you go.
In other words, they're to oppose every infraction. When the federal government decides to deviate or go away from those things delegated or assume powers not delegated, to directly violate them or to assume new powers, doesn't matter. Every state, and the state of Virginia is basically, he's saying that we're going to do this because a faithful observance of these, or making sure that we apply this or ensure that the federal government stays within compliance, is the only mechanism to ensure our existence and happiness. I can't express really this, you know, what he's basically saying here, folks. As I say at the beginning of every show, it is all about full compliance of that Constitution, which is why every infraction must be opposed. Okay. Now he gets into the, you know, into the real, you know, the depth and the details of all of this in the report later on, in the next document he produces regarding this whole thing. And so we'll get into some of that clarity, because the question is, you know, we need to oppose and call somebody out when they basically have spent money on something they had no authority to do. And the magnitude of what we want to do to, you know, hold that person accountable, you know, should be requisite to the offense. In other words, if maybe somebody did something that, you know, was just a bad character, and it was an infraction of the Constitution by not, you know, providing respect, dignity, what have you, whatever it is, you know, it, you want to make sure, because Madison points out in the report later on that, you know, we want to make sure that one, the violation was significant, material, and willful. So, and we'll dive into that, because there's no point, you know, in basically saying the whole world's going to end because you guys, you know, created, you know, assumed a power to do something that, you know, innocuous, what have you. Is it really going to, you know, like when they assumed the bank? They assumed the bank as a mechanism to do something. The world didn't come to an end, nor did Madison and Jefferson, you know, take the measures to oppose that infraction by calling upon the states. In other words, going down this exact same path. For whatever reason, they didn't see that infraction necessary to get to this point. Does that make sense, John?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. And
I wish they would have.
Yeah, so me too. Me too, because I think it would have helped lay the groundwork when they got to this level of actually attacking the liberties of the people, because that's why they're stepping up. The liberties of the people are at stake here. What's next? They're going to start dictating religion upon us, and they're going to start, you know, taking away our right of conscience. I mean, those types of things were just absolutely, you know, a line that a government should never cross. Anyway, so in the third resolution, he expounds now on what he basically talks about in this opposing every infraction. He expounds upon that right here in the third resolution. So let's go ahead and get into that.
Number three, that this assembly doth explicitly and preemptorily declare that it views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties as limited by the plain sense and intention of the instrument constituting the compact, as no further valid that they are authorized by the grants enumerated in that compact, and that in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right, are in duty bound, and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil, and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them.
Wow. Okay, so he now basically, they start this next resolution off with explicitly and emphatically or preemptorily declare that this state legislature views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are the parties as limited and plain, just like Thomas Jefferson laid them out. And then he says, jumping down, he says, that in cases of deliberate, you know, purposeful and dangerous exercises, or palpable, blatant and dangerous exercises of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states or the parties thereto have the right and are duty bound. He says, and are in duty bound, but and are duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil. So the question is, and this goes to what Thomas Jefferson was saying, that the states, you know, clearly have a right to nullify. Madison is pointing out that the state's first action, you know, if you got a process, you know, like you break down, okay, we have a decision process to make. You know, you got this wheel or, you know, a hierarchy of how do we, when a problem comes in, how do we resolve that? We go to this, is this really palpable, deliberate, meaningful? Yes. If so, then we go down the no, then we go down to this other path. You know, and maybe we, if it's our representative, we basically remove that representative, you know, and we replace them. If it's another state, then, you know, we'll tell that other state, hey, you know, that's repugnant of what your guy, you know, your representative has done, your senator, you need to replace them, in our view. You know, let them make the final decision because it's up to them. But the point is that you have, there is this process. And Jefferson just jumped to the ultimate end. If the problem is so, you know, I'll just say so egregious that the state feels its existence and sovereignty is in jeopardy, that regardless of what the other states do, because technically Thomas Jefferson was calling for nullification. And you're going to find when we get into the next resolution that comes from that, they choose not to actually nullify. They're calling for this motion or this process. So in other words, he's calling for this thoughtful process of coordinating and everything else. Are you going to nullify? Are we going to nullify? Or what are we going to do? And Madison is pointing out that the first step is actually to interpose, that the states must actually look and say, hey, this is an infraction. This is a significant infraction, so significant that we actually have to take action. Instead of revolting, you don't have to take up arms. In this union, you don't have to take up arms. You can just step away and say, we're done. This is so egregious, we're done. But Madison is saying, you know, what we need to do, what we all need to do is instead of dissolving the union, we need to hold this creature, this federal government, accountable and interpose. So what does interpose mean, Sean?
I can't give you a...
Well, you can look it up. But
definition, right.
Yeah, yeah, you can go ahead and look
but
it
I
up.
I mean, to intervene, to step in and would say use your authority.
Yeah, so one of the words, I think, if you look it up, is seize. Interpose means seize. In other words, you reach in and you stop them. It's, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, you can't do that. But interposition is literally stopping them by whatever mechanism you have in the Constitution to do so. Now, are there mechanisms in the Constitution 1798 that they could actually seize the day or actually be able to seize the federal government? Interesting. That was an echo. But so, yes, there is. They could have charged treason. They could have basically replaced their senators. They could have gone through purging out the representatives of the state that were sitting there that voted for it from Virginia, from Kentucky, and from all the other states that felt that this was that significant that you have basically violated our trust in you as our representatives in ensuring our suffrage would be literally recognized. So we're going into a break real quick here. So when we come back, we'll kind of, you know, close on this. What does this interposition really mean? What's really on the table that Madison is talking about? So that we can kind of look at what was available to them at that point in time. And then we can kind of, you know, finish going through this. But I want to introduce you to what we have available today that they didn't have available. So we'll be right back after this short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Madison gets this this term out that most people aren't even familiar with. It's called interposition. And so he lays out this action that basically talks about seizing, arresting, stopping what they are doing. In their day, they had tools of representation and pulling these guys back. You know, they also had this thing called honor and integrity. That back in those days, you know, all you had to do was label somebody, label lynch them as a treasonous, you know, tyrant. Then shoot, we've already said that back in those days they had the ability to challenge you to a duel. But when a state legislature labels you that way, I mean, it's just like, that's almost a kiss of death to, you know, calling out very specific people of Congress that are representing that state, you know, as, you know, violators, but basically treasonous. But the reality is treason against the United States Constitution, the jurisdiction of that or the court that tries that is the federal court. There's not a lot of hope and faith that the federal court would actually hold these men to treason. Who knows? It's, you know, so the question is, do they want to go down that path of just label lynching these guys, challenging them, removing them? They didn't have a real good mechanism of removal. They had the ability to you know, whip up some yarn and, you know, tell the good tales and get the, you know, promulgate the information, let everybody know what scoundrels these people are, but there wasn't really any teeth in the Constitution. Pulling back senators is something that actually could have happened, because the state legislature at any point in time could pull back a senator for violating their trust. So the fact that the bill, this Alien and Seditions Act, made it through both House and Senate, if the Senate of the Virginia senators, I should say, the Virginia senators, if they passed that bill, they should have actually said, hey, you got to come back. Same thing with Kentucky. They had those measures. And the other thing is that they can start calling on basically impeachment of the President of the United States for signing a bill or signing these acts that violated the Constitution. I mean, but that was the direction that they felt they needed to go and all agree upon. They needed to get all of the other states to agree to interpose. So in other words, before they could make this arrest, before they could really seize the federal government, they needed the force of the states to join them, which is why they're making this appeal and why this kind of, I'll just say, I don't want to call it hyperbole or hyperbole. What I want to do is they're really stating what needs to happen. And so that's why they say that, you know, when they're exercising these unconstitutional powers, violating the Constitution, they must interpose for the arresting of the progress of evil so that they can maintain the actual limits on government as well as maintain their liberties and rights. So now we go into, and actually, did you have anything to add or anything else before we move on? And no? Okay. So, Sean, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I muted myself when I started to talk.
Okay.
I was going to say, you said look up interposition, and our friends at Wikipedia have a whole page on interposition, and they adamantly exclaimed that in Cooper v. Aaron, the Supreme Court rejected interposition explicitly. The Supreme Court and lower federal courts have consistently held that the power to declare federal laws unconstitutional lies with the federal judiciary, not with the states.
And so, hold on here. This is all interesting.
Mm-hmm.
As we'll get into this, and actually, what I'd like you to do is, you know, forward me that, because what I want to do is I want to create a contrast and comparison, and let Madison argue and lay out, because basically what the court has said is that whether you like our rules or not, there's no way out. When actually, the Constitution, Article 3 of the Constitution, thank God, everybody, we just went through this, right? The jurisdiction of the court is limited to what?
Things of the Constitution.
All things arising under this Constitution, and all laws made in pursuance thereof, and treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States. In other words, everything that they have the authority to do, the federal court has the ability to be the final arbiter in a court of law. However, when the courts have started redefining, and those redefinitions are actually violations of the Constitution over matters that arise under the Constitution, they can't contain that, you know, put a little lid over that and say, oh, well, this arises under the Constitution. Well, hold on here. There's nowhere in the Constitution that gives you the ability to redefine something in the Constitution. So when you've redefined something to say, well, this equal protection in the 14th Amendment means that you can actually create, you know, create segregation, and that's equal but separate. The concept of equal but separate, the Jim Crow laws was a direct violation of the Constitution of equal protection under the law as defined in the 14th Amendment. So the court comes along and says, we're going to redefine that. And we're going to say it's okay to segregate. And it's okay to create an oppressive environment to those you don't like. That in itself, even when you look at the segregation laws and allow a disparity in the quality and conditions of these different environments of the separate but equal, that is tantamount for the state allowing bills of attainder and punishment to be doled out. In other words, a bill of attainder and punishment basically says that a class of people, let's say blacks, they don't deserve the same accommodations, and so you can create austere conditions, you know, subpar, you know, quality of conditions in their environment, what have you, it's okay. By basically segregating or creating a class and a punishment for that class. That's what a bill of attainder and punishment is. The federal government is constrained from doing that, as well as the states. So I'm saying, when we start really looking at the Constitution and the way the courts have constantly played this, I'll just say, this godlike role of taking the law, putting it in this special legal liquid where they can, you know, soften it and start bending it and twisting it and redefining it, they don't have that authority. As a matter of fact, when you read in Article 3 of the Constitution, they don't have the ability to interpret. They don't have the ability to go out and say, well, we think this. There's nothing we can find. We can't find anything that defines this. What do? They actually have to go to Congress and say, we don't understand the context of this, and we need to go to the parties because only they can provide those definitions. Because if it's something in the Constitution that actually falls under Congress's power, I'll give you a good example. The power to make a uniform rule of naturalization. So when Congress creates the law of that, they have the ability to define those things of the U.S. citizen, so forth. And in so doing, that becomes the legal definitions and standards because it's within Congress's will. Well, if it is something that is not within the federal government's authority to do, and let's just say the when we look at Article 1, Section 1, and the apportionment clause that each state shall be, you know, shall have, or I should say the persons of the state, the representative shall not exceed 30,000 people of the persons of the state for representation in the House. That's right there in Article 1, Section 3. The Supreme Court can't come along and say, well, we think Congress can redefine that. No, they can't. It's not a power that they can legislate. It is a standard. It is a role, responsibility. Those things are finite, which is why when we had a problem with the Electoral College in 1800, they had to go through, because that was Article 2, the language and roles and responsibilities of the president. The roles and responsibilities of Congress are clearly not legislatable for Congress to start making it up as they go along. And so to change that 30,000 literally requires an amendment, which, oh, by the way, folks, that's why Madison actually created an amendment to address that, because he knew it was going to require an amendment. He knew that one day the growth of the Union would continue to where it would need that amendment, and it's sitting out there, and it's been ratified, but that's all another problem. We covered that, by the way, when we covered the Constitution. The fact of the matter is the courts have basically said nobody can defy us. We are God. And the Constitution did not give them that ability or authority. They've been contained. And again, in Article 3, they are bound by law and fact, not by interpretation. They don't have the ability to redefine so they can make it up the way they want to. It has to be based on law and fact. Not their law, the Constitution, and how the Constitution was defined by the states, by the parties. So Madison gets into this very specifically in the report. Apparently I kind of touched this on interposition, and we had to dive into it because there in Wikipedia is promulgating and propagating the lie that the federal courts do have these authorities. And I'm here to tell you, you know, Wikipedia can be a decent tool, but it can also be a great propaganda tool. Anyway, anything else?
Yeah, it was funny that it was like off to the side of the, you know, how you get your results for your search. It was like the de facto official version. It's funny. It's just funny the way they have things structured now. In the internet.
Yep. Yes. Right. With AI.
Yes. If you go looking for that, that's the first thing you're going to see.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Because they want you to just eat, because most people are just going to eat so much, and they're going to eat what falls on their plate. Oh well. You know, if this is the prevailing definition, then yeah, okay, I got to go by that. We've been programmed to basically do what we're told. And so they're telling you in that first line what they want you to believe. We're telling you otherwise, folks. That's why we're going through this. And so let's dive into the fourth resolution. Let's go ahead.
Number four, that the General Assembly doth also express its deep regret that a spirit has in sundry instances been manifested by the federal government to enlarge its powers by forced constructions of the constitutional charter which defines them, and that implications have appeared of a design to expound certain general phrases which having been copied from the very limited grant of power in the former Articles of Confederation were the less liable to be misconstrued, so as to destroy the meaning and effect of the particular enumeration which necessarily explains and limits the general phrases, and so as to consolidate the states by degrees into one sovereignty, the obvious tendency and inevitable consequence of which would be to transform the present republican system of the United States into an absolute or at best a mixed monarchy.
Okay, so so what is he talking about in this particular resolution? So he's pointing out something. Okay, so the General Assembly doth also express its deep regret and spirit in a sundry of instances has been manifest. In other words, a variety of things the federal government has done to enlarge its powers. This is an oblique pointing to the Assumption Act, the Bank Act, and some of these other things that they've been trying to do and they've gotten away with, which basically is providing powers that are outside that constitutional charter or outside the Constitution. Why he used charter, I think that was more of the... Because the legislature had control over the actual language of what they were going to sign off on. So I don't think... Because Madison, never saw him refer to the Constitution personally as a charter. But anyway, as you go through this, he then says, which have been copied from the very limited grant of power in the former Articles of Confederation. Do you know what those former powers are? You know what he's talking about with that?
Not specifically, no, sir.
Oh, okay. So in the Articles of Confederation, at the very top of the Articles of Confederation, there is, and actually, let me pull it up real quick. I'll tell you which article is. It's like two or three. It's number two. And it says this: each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Well, what he's talking about here is he basically says this was included with the Constitution in an amendment form. He doesn't basically say that, but he says, hold on here. We actually had the exact same constraints so that the federal government could not get out of these tight enumerations, that they could only function within those expressly delegated powers. That's what he's talking about here. And so they basically said, we're not accountable for this. We can do whatever we want, which basically makes them at best a mixed monarchy, if not, you know, I'd say more an oligarchy, what have you. But anyway, that makes sense, okay? So let's dive into the fifth article.
Already, that the General Assembly doth particularly protest against the palpable and alarming infractions of the Constitution. In the two late cases of the Alien and Sedition Acts passed in the last session of Congress, the first of which exercised a power nowhere delegated to the federal government, and which by uniting legislative and judicial powers to those of executive, subverts the general principles of free government, as well as the particular organization and positive provisions of the federal Constitution, and the other of which acts exercise in like manner a power not delegated by the Constitution, but on the contrary, expressly and positively forbidden by one of the amendments thereto, a power which more than any other ought to produce universal alarm, because it is leveled against that right of freely examining public characters and measures, and of free communication among the people thereon, which has ever been justly deemed the only effectual guardian of every other right.
Okay, so he's again, so what is he pointing to? Because what he says here, expressly and positively forbidden by one of the amendments thereto.
The first one?
Well, the tenth. Oh, you know what? So you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, because the Alien Sedition Acts actually took away the powers of, you know, the speech and these other ones. But, and the executive subverts the general principles. So what he's kind of doing here is he's assisting in how Jefferson audited the Constitution and pointing out how, because Jefferson pointed to the 10th Amendment, he pointed to the 1st Amendment, and so forth and so on. And so he also pointed to some of the articles with the refugees, or the importation, as well as immigration itself. So what he's doing here is he's kind of providing, or, you know, fortifying how Jefferson had audited and pointed out how these directly violated the Constitution. And it's kind of in a summation form here. Because basically, as you look at this, the only thing that has to happen is the sounding the alarm that the states need to actually do something, which basically, as he says, All of these things ought to produce universal alarm because it is levied against the right of freely examining public characters and measures and of free communication. So you're right. He's talking here about the First Amendment. The Tenth Amendment was the one before. But but he doesn't say that. In other words, he's doing this more in a summation. Thomas Jefferson literally did go through the nuts and bolts of, you know, how each of these laws deliberately violated this part of the Constitution, this amendment, so forth and so on. He broke it down. So Madison kind of just creates these two, the first one being the Tenth Amendment and this one being, hey, you know, they're clearly violating these rights of expression, First Amendment rights and so forth. So the sixth one, let's go ahead and go into this one.
That this state, having by its convention, which ratified the federal constitution, expressly declared that among other essential rights, the liberty of conscience and of the press cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by any authority of the United States, and from its extreme anxiety to guard these rights from every possible attack of sophistry or ambition, having recommended an amendment for that purpose, which amendment was in due time annexed to the Constitution. It would mark a reproachable inconsistency and criminal degeneracy if an indifference were not shown to the most palpable violation of one of the rights thus declared and secured, and to the establishment of a precedent which may be fatal to the other.
Okay, so again, he's still building on that whole thing, but he's actually pointing out that this state itself, after the ratification of the federal constitution, how we basically made this declaration that the liberty of conscience and of the press, the liberty of conscience, what does that mean?
Freedom of speech.
Well, so the liberty of conscience means the ability to be an objector as well, right? What's a conscientious objector?
Right.
So today,
somebody who objects because of their conscience for principle or values and morals,
irregardless, right? Irregardless. Yeah. So, in other words, what would so today, a conscientious objector can only be a person that doesn't want to take up arms to support the Constitution or go into the military. But technically, today, a conscientious objector can be a person that doesn't want a vaccination, can be a person that wants, a person can opt out of anything. You can be a conscientious objector for not having and not carrying a real ID. I mean, so you hear me, but nobody ever calls me on this, and that's okay. But you hear me rail on state nationals and so forth, national citizens. You know, these people that have, you know, gotten away from having an ID or a driver's license. Your conscientious objection, you have a right to conscientiously object to having a real ID card. You know, and so if you're going, so Montana is just now implementing into their driver's license the Real ID Act, or I should say they're implementing it. So anybody that goes and gets their license updated, that information will be ported into the federal registry. You have a right to opt out of that. And as a matter of fact, the state has a responsibility of protecting your Fourth Amendment right because you have a right to be secure in your person. And the whole point of the Real ID Act is to be able to use your facial signature to be able to see you in a camera monitoring system so that they can, oh, that's you. Well, they don't have any right to identify you out of a crowd. You have a right to be secure that everybody in that crowd has a right to be anonymous. For them to say, where is this person in this crowd, to be looking at all and saying, who's in this crowd, they need a writ. In other words, they need to have a signed warrant from a judge basically saying, you can search the crowd for that person. They've been arguing in the Fields Doctrine that in open fields and in public arenas, you don't have the right of privacy. Well, you actually do have the right of privacy at all times against the government, against you know, your shopping mall, against the people of your community, not the government. If you're a store owner, if you want to implement that type of technology, you'd have to create your own database. So it's almost unfathomable to be able to do this on your own. They had to do government to get government to do this. But when you look at the Fourth Amendment is very clear that you are to be secure in your person. If I remember correctly, when we look at the Fourth Amendment, it actually goes into as well as your person, your property, your effects, all of that type of stuff. This is what it says. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, in your person. So as you walk around, you're to be secure in that. As you walk around, you are to be secure that, you know, you are you. If there's a reason with probable cause for them to come up and say, how you doing? If you are suspected of committing a crime, then they have to have a warrant because that's what it says. House, you are to be securing their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall be issued but upon probable cause. So they have to have probable cause to be looking for you, period. And if they actually are using all of the faces in a database, that means they're looking at everybody. So that means that you're no longer secure in your persons because you're in their database. One of the things that they did rule rightly, correctly, was DNA. When you were, you know, when there was a warrant because of a crime, and they basically said, you know, that a judge provided a warrant to provide this, you know, blood or DNA test to be done upon some suspect because of probable cause, the judge said, okay, you can get their DNA. If that DNA was not a match, that DNA was to be expunged and not entered into a database. The only database that they were to have was a database of those who were convicted. And if that person actually ends up becoming innocent after their conviction because of, you know, other bad or, you know, somebody else confesses, whatever, then it's supposed to be expunged. They're not to keep that database. Only those criminals they are allowed to keep because of, you know, the laws they've passed to do that. Because technically, now, most people don't even know this, that once you commit a law, once you break a felony, you violate the law in a felony way, you actually have, the state has the ability to remove your citizen's rights. You know that, right? I mean, back in the old days, if you committed a felony, you were convicted of a felony, went to jail, you would lose your right to vote, and you would lose all of your other rights. And so the Fourth Amendment no longer applied to a convicted felon. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's why they can come in your house if you're on parole or probation or whatever.
Yes, that's correct. So, but that's, you know, you have to be exonerated. So I didn't realize because I had some documents covering the display that we were running out of time. So unfortunately, we've ran out of time. So we will have to pick it up on the next resolution when we come back with Tammy. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.